You're listening to Radio Influence.
He heard it.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the count.
Wow.
And here comes a mitchell. And it's all over. It's all over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the Halloween edition of the MMA Report podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Floyd. Up here on this week's edition of the show, we're going to discuss a tweet that Flow Combat put out on Tuesday about you have to save two UFC fighters at rest get released. Who are we going to pick? We'll let you know that. Also, we'll preview Saturday's UFC 230. Going to have three interviews for you, as I had a chance earlier this week to chat with manager and coach Tyson Chartier. Of course, runs Top Game Management, coaches a lot of Northeast fighters, notably Calvin Cater, who got a win this past weekend, also involved with Andre Sukenthaw and Rob Font, among many other UFC fighters as well. Plus, we'll talk to Montel Jackson, who's going to be fighting on Saturday at UFC 230. Also, you're hearing my conversation with Anthony Romero, who's got a fight come up here at King of the Cage. Also, we're going to talk about the quote-unquote trade that has gone on between the UFC and ONE Championship with Ben Askren and Demetrius Johnson. Plus, we'll talk about some of the latest news and notes. Of course, coming up here also on this week's edition of the podcast, we're going to tell you about MyBookie, the offer MyBookie has for the MMA Report podcast listeners. Also, tell you about an offer that Romans has for our listeners as well. Of course, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on that podcast, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play. Of course, always available at RadioInfluence.com. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Jason, I am doing quite well. It is Halloween here in the country of the United States of America. And I do not have my Conor McGregor costume, but maybe I should go and buy one. But I can't afford it because I think to dress like Conor McGregor, Jason, you got to go out there and draw like 2.some million on pay-per-view buy rates.
Look, if someone comes to my house tonight dressed as in any UFC fighter kit, I'm going to start asking questions. Okay, I might go in full interview mode at that moment. Where did you get this? Where was the thought for it? I might just go full interview style.
What went wrong in your life that you bought a fighter kit? Like, that's what you got to ask that 7-year-old at your door.
I was at Target on Tuesday. And I saw this father trying to get a late costume for his daughter. And you could tell he was not having a fun day. You could tell he wasn't.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than that Monday rush of, oh, crap, my child doesn't have a costume. We got to go to the store. And it's just packed. It's just the worst inside there is everyone's looking at all these crappy costumes. Like all these costumes that are sold are the worst things ever. Like, they are just total crap, man. I mean, literally, and not including the poop emoji. Like I went to a costume store on Monday with a girl, and we looked through all the costumes and not impressed, Jason. They all looked very, very cheaply made at a very expensive price. I'm like, we could do a DIY and do this whole deal. But yes, like you, I will dress in my normal everyday costume, which is just street clothes.
I will be sitting on my couch, passing out candy, and watching whatever's on TV. That'll pretty much be my Halloween night. But I mentioned about this tweet that Flow Combat put out there on Tuesday, and they do this every once in a while, and I thought it'd be good to kind of hear our picks. It said, save two fighters, the rest get released. And so here are the fighters: John Jones, Daniel Cormier, Anderson Silva, Brian Ortega, Nate Diaz, Khabib Nurmagomedov, Colby Covington, Conor McGregor, Max Holloway, Israel Adesanya, Chris Cyborg, and Derek Lewis. Now, I think everyone's going to have kind of how they view this. You know, some of my criteria in this was age, long-term value, fan interest, and, well, if I'm running the UFC, how much money can this fighter make me? There were certain fighters that were very easy for me to eliminate right from the start. And there was five names that jumped out to me. Did you have a couple of names that immediately you're like, okay, XF fighter out there, they're definitely not making the cut?
I mean, just a couple. And to me, literally the answer is two or three that I just completely didn't take a second longer to look at. And if we're, I would say immediately, and for those who maybe aren't aware of the fighters, basically the game is save two fighters, the rest get released. And the 12 fighters you got are John Jones, DC, Anderson Silva, Brian Ortega, Nate Diaz, Nurmagomedov, Covington, Conor McGregor, Max Holloway, Israel Adesanya, Cyborg, and Derek Lewis. And the three or four, yeah, I guess the three that immediately jumped out to me, Jason, that just no-go is Adesanya, Colby Covington, and Anderson Silva.
Okay, one of those fighters was in my initial five.
Which of those was it? Was it Covington?
Anderson Silva.
Really? Anderson Silva?
Age. How much more is left in the gas tank in Anderson Silva? It primarily was age. I'll tell you another one who's in my top five that might surprise some people.
Who's that?
Daniel Cormier.
That one does not surprise me at all. That one does not surprise me at all because two things. If you're in the UFC, you don't mind being in the Daniel Cormier business post-UFC career. You know, he is a guy – I don't know. Oh, I think I was listening to the Wrestling Observer, and they were talking about, like, who could be the next Dana White after Dana White. And one of the names out there was Daniel Cormier. He could theoretically be the next Dana White. So, I mean, there's a lot of value there just as a commentator, et cetera. But I could see that for sure because, to me, when I look – and if you're going to look at these 12 guys, I mean – Daniel Cormier and also Cyborg, Daniel Cormier is absolutely in the top half when it comes to name value and notoriety for sure. And he's also got the talent level. But again, much like Anderson, age is a big factor. And he was high up my list, Jason. But the way I kind of went about looking at this was like I separated into two categories for the two guys that I wanted. I was going to get my pay-per-view draw, the guy who might only fight once a year. And I was going to get a fighter who fights constantly and is very fun. They may not do as big business, but I still want them on my roster. That's kind of how I went about it, Jason. So I almost had him in two different categories. And I put DC in that former category of the star, etc. And to me, the reason why I didn't give DC too much of a second thought after saying, you know, he's pretty good and he's valuable, is there's only one guy I want in that star category, and it's Conor McGregor.
Yeah, Conor McGregor is one of my two. I will tell you, my second pick, it came down to two fighters. I'll get into that here shortly. Cyborg is in my top five to get rid of immediately. And the reason is just like Daniel Cormier. You know, Cormier, it's age and the fact that he's already said, hey, I'm retiring, you know, once retire in March 2019. We'll see whether or not that truly happens. For Cyborg, she only has one fight left on her UFC deal. And, you know, she hasn't exactly sat there and made it clear that she sees herself fighting, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road, even though she does have new management. So she was in my top five. Colby Covington was in my top five just because primarily has a fighting style that I just don't think is going to draw fans' attention. And I think he's just going to say something stupid to a point where the UFC is going to say, nah, we don't want to be in your business anymore.
Yeah, so just to round, so you're talking about the top five that you eliminated, right?
Eliminated immediately. So I can tell you, my top five that I eliminated immediately was Anderson, Daniel Cormier, Colby Covington, Chris Cyborg, and you're going to be surprised by the fifth one.
Is it Derek Lewis?
No, it's Nate Diaz.
Wow.
Reason being, clearly the UFC can't even get him to the cage. You know, yeah. And there, I think it's probably more of, A, the issues the UFC is having in him getting him to agree to a fight and kind of, you know, if you're talking about you can only keep two fighters, you want to have fighters that you believe you can count on to be there for you, you know, to put together a big fight card. And with Nate Diaz right now, I just don't know how the UFC can count on him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you gave me an over-under for three for the amount of Nate Diaz fights we'll see in the UFC for the rest of his career, I might take the under there. I could certainly see that. It seems like once in a blue moon, he will find his way to the UFC octagon. And I get why you put him there. I mean, DC and Cyborg are the two of the five that you eliminated that jump out to me. But I understand the reasoning. It's the fact that long term, they're not going to be there. But I will say just that Cyborg is incredibly valuable currently to the UFC just based on the fact that she does draw somewhat on pay-per-view. She really does, which is, there is value there. Israel Adesanya made the cut, and so did Derek Lewis. I mean, those are two guys who I look at, and I look at Derek Lewis, and I'm like, I love this guy so much. But also long-term, he does have pretty decent back issues, and I do think this is maybe a situation where he's going to get real close to the sun, and he's about to get knocked back down by Cormier, and it may not be long-term at the same level as some of these other guys. And for Adesanya, I mean, he's a phenomenal talent, but the potential is still there, and it's not necessarily realizing it quite yet.
Now, in terms of Israel Adesanya, you're going to be surprised where he was at on my cut list.
I'm assuming this guy made very high on your cut list.
He was the 9th out of 10 cuts.
Wow.
Because I looked at it, I said, he's 29 years old. He has a fighting style that you like. And I mean, and he's still raw, though. So it's like you really, you don't know kind of where that ceiling is. I mean, and to me, I mean, at number 6 for me, it was Khabib. I mean, look, Khabib is a tremendous fighter. But he has a fighting style that a high percentage of people are just not going to enjoy. I think we've always talked about that. Number 7 for me was Derek Lewis. You know, Derek, age is not necessarily a concern, especially at heavyweight. He's only 33 years old, which is pretty young in the heavyweight division. But I think you look at his skill set, there is liabilities with his skill set, because clearly, I mean, look, the guy can be dead tired and still knock you out, but man, he can get taken down pretty easily.
Totally. The age is not there, but again, the issue is the back, given that we basically already saw him retire in the cage. like he has already retired once, and he is lovable and he is amazing. That's maybe why I would maybe switch him and Nurmagomedov. I mean, Khabib does not have the fighting style at all. He is Colby Covington 2.0 in terms of fan entertainment when the bell rings, for sure. I mean, he's a bit more enjoyable to watch fight than Covington, for sure, based on like what he does when he's in top position. And sometimes he does take chances on the feet, as we saw when he dropped Conor McGregor. But Nurmagomedov, even though his name value is higher than it's ever been, it's like I don't necessarily know if I sign him, I keep him out of the rest, if he's going to be a super duper star against people who aren't named Conor McGregor. So I certainly understand there.
So I have eliminated 7 fighters. So my final 5 fighters are John Jones, Brian Ortega, Conor McGregor, Max Holloway, and Israel Adesanya. I've already told you Adesanya's not going to make cuts. So who are your final 5 guys as you're kind of dwindling this list down?
Yeah, the final 5 guys, and again, I have 2 different categories. I have the super duper stars, and then I have the potential guys. And in my super duper stars, I had Conor, I had Daniel Cormier, and I had John Jones. I'm just going to take one of those 3. I want to take one of those guys to build my big shows around and inflate my average. And when I'm looking for potential, Adesanya is certainly interesting, but he didn't make the cut for me. To me, it comes down to the featherweights. Brian Ortega, Max Holloway. I mean, those are 2 of the most promising stars in the UFC. One who's 26, one who's 27, and Ortega. And that is my top 5, Jason. I have one guy who I want to be like, this is my freaking, my Floyd Mayweather. This is my major superstar. And then I want a guy who's going to fight 3 times a year. So that's my top 5.
Now,
Ortega, Holloway, Jones, DC, and McGregor.
So in terms of my final 5, and this is where it kind of got tough when you start to kind of figure it out, I eliminated John Jones. Now, look, I think John Jones is an incredible fighter. Can't trust the guy.
Absolutely agree with you. I mean, look at the amount of trouble. For the vast majority of this podcast, most episodes in which we've talked about John Jones, it has not been about him in the cage.
No. It's just, if you're the UFC, you just can't trust John Jones. I mean, that's plain and simple. So I eliminated John Jones. So then I get down to my 9th elimination was Israel Adesanya. Then this became the tough one. Holloway or Ortega. You know, it's, part of me said Ortega. You know what? Because of the things that have happened over the last year with Max Holloway, but I ended up going with Max Holloway over Brian Ortega. So my 2 would be Conor and Max Holloway.
Oh, we have very similar lists. I did not go Holloway. I did go with Ortega, even though I might still pick Holloway in the fight. But the reason why I went with Brian Ortega over Max Holloway is that, hey, in this given reality, they don't have to fight. So, you know, even if Holloway is the quote-unquote better fighter, you know, Ortega certainly doesn't have to fight him. So he can just be, you know, known as the best featherweight in the world. But the reason why I went with Ortega is the injuries Holloway has suffered. I'm kind of concerned about that. Ortega is a guy who I think is just I mean, you can't go wrong with either guy. Both guys are freaking dynamite inside the cage and talented as well. So that's kind of the main reason why I went with Ortega, is just that with Max Holloway, I'm a bit more concerned about ring availability. So, yeah, we have very similar list, Connor and Ortega. I will say if Connor wasn't a part of the picture, I would probably have picked John Jones over Daniel Cormier, just because even though you can't trust the guy, I still want to take a big risk on a guy who I think has the most potential to do business. And out of, if we eliminate Conor McGregor, I think John Jones is the clear number two when it comes to who has the biggest potential to do business. So that would have been my third guy to pick if Conor was not a part of the list. And if I could not pick Ortega, Jason, my list would look exactly like yours with Holloway and Conor.
Yeah, I mean, it's it was an interesting tweet that Flo put out there. You know, because I think a lot of people are just going to have different lists out there. Of course, two of those guys that were mentioned, DC and Derek Lewis, of course, they're going to be headlining Saturday's UFC 230 at MSG in New York City. It's a fight card that, you know, when you look at it on paper, it's not awful. I don't think it's going to do well on pay-per-view, but I think overall, when you look top to bottom, it's a decent top-to-bottom card.
Oh, yeah, man. This is a card where if you're a hardcore MMA fan, you know what's up. You get pumped for Chris Weidman, Jacare Souza. You look at Derek Brunson, Israel Adesanya, and you say, that's pretty damn interesting. You look at Cesaro Eubanks and you say, man, she's, okay, never mind. But you look at the main event and you're like, I'm down to see Derek Lewis walk to the cage. But the big struggle here is not for the hardcore MMA fan. It's the fact that for UFC 230, the reputation surrounding it is when you go to Madison Square Garden, it is one of the biggest events in the UFC calendar year. And even though Daniel Cormier is on this card, it is so forced that this does not feel like it. And that's kind of why it's a bit of a Debbie Downer. But as a general fan of mixed martial arts, you can look at this card, Jason, and absolutely find reasons to watch it.
This is how I look at the main event. Derek Lewis, win-win situation. Not much to lose besides an L going on your record. Daniel Cormier has everything to lose and not much to gain.
No, here's where I disagree with you. What if Derek Lewis is a patient young man and he waits and waits until that heavyweight title is vacant in about a year? I think the opportunity to become heavyweight champion is much easier than maybe a loss here to Daniel Cormier sends him in a tailspin and he can't recover. So that's where there's something to lose. Now, he could still lose a DC and get himself back in the heavyweight title picture when it becomes vacated, if it does become vacant. So that is where he does have something to lose. But again, when you frame it that way, I get what you're saying, because at the end of the day, everyone who watches knows what's up. Derek Lewis has a puncher's chance in this fight. That's what it is. Daniel Cormier has displayed himself at a different level. Now, there's been lots of talk about Daniel Cormier has been suffering from hand injuries. That could absolutely throw him off in this fight. And even though it's clear Cormier is just an unbelievable wrestler, he has the ability to take down Lewis. He has the ability to destroy him in the midsection and really make him have a rough night with his stand-up. If you're not 100%, or if you're significantly lower than that, we have seen the power of Derek Lewis. He is one of the hardest hitters I've ever seen in the UFC. And you come in there with issues, Lewis can win this win-win situation and become UFC heavyweight champion at the end of the day. When we talk about puncher's chance, that is never more true than in the heavyweight division. And in that heavyweight division, that is never more true than with Derek Lewis.
Well, the reason on the Cormier side to me why this is there's not much to gain for him here is you lose this fight, all of a sudden, the ideal scenario on the way to end his career takes a massive hit. And obviously, the ideal situation for Cormier is a win here, fights, you know, early on 2019, sometime in the first couple months of the year, against Brock Lesnar, and then the summer he fights John Jones. That has got to be the absolute best picture for DC. But if he loses this fight, all of a sudden the Brock Lesnar fight likely goes away, and who knows what happens if a Jones fight maybe comes together at some point. I mean, of course, DC has talked about the fact of, you know, currently he is still a light heavyweight champion, and mentioning that, hey, if for some reason I lose my belt, the heavyweight title on Saturday night, that, hey, I'm still a light heavyweight champion. I'll go back down to 205 pounds, which he's noted that the only fight he's going to go down to 205 pounds for is John Jones, which obviously makes all the sense in the world. For Derek Lewis, I mean, the thing that amazes you about him is the fact that this is a guy that gets tired but still has knockout power. Typically, we don't necessarily see that in fighters. And, you know, for Derek Lewis to win this fight, I mean, I think it's got to be a situation where Cormier is not have a forward pressure in the fight, which is I expect. I expect him just to kind of straight up bring the fight. But also what concerns me is this, is it these hand issues that DC has. What happens if, you know, within the first 10 seconds of this fight, let's say he breaks his hand and all of a sudden he now doesn't have one of his tool sets. You know, how does that affect the fight going on? I mean, look, I'm not picking Derek Lewis to win this fight. I think that you will see Cormier win. I think he wins in the first 10 minutes, and I think he's going to submit Derek Lewis.
I mean, if he comes in, he breaks his hand, and he has to withdraw from the contest, we have a new champion. If he finds out that he can't physically fight, I mean, it is a major, major, major risk for Daniel Cormier to take this fight. You're right. If he loses, the Brock Lesnar fight's probably out the window, because I mean, Brock Lesnar is a very delicate individual. I mean, when it comes to doing business with Brock Lesnar, he knows where his money's at, and he probably only wants to fight one more time. So if he can find a reason to only do it once with John Jones, he'll only do it once with John Jones. And Daniel Cormier losing the heavyweight division probably tells that. But I do think win or lose, if he loses, we still see Daniel Cormier, John Jones, just because that is a money fight. That's probably the next fight no matter what happens. I mean, heck, even if John Jones loses to Alexander Gustafsson and Daniel Cormier beats Derek Lewis, I think we're going to still see Cormier versus John Jones. I think Cormier is going to fight Jones over Gustafsson, the champion, if something like that were to take place. Just because Cormier Jones has money written all over it. They are two known commodities, two guys. When you think of one, you will think of the other as a career rival. So it just seems like these are just on a head-on destination. Now the risk is potentially we're talking about an older Cormier whose body just cannot fight anymore. I don't think that's the case, but with something like a hand, that's something that takes a while to heal. Sometimes it doesn't really heal 100%. So there's plenty of concern, even though you look at the odds and you see that Daniel Cormier is a 700 favorite in some places, 800 in others. This is a fight in which there are plenty of like red blaring signals for why there should be an upset because of Derek Lewis's ability to survive. And we saw his last fight against Alexander Volkov, who was a very talented heavyweight, but obviously at a lower tier than Daniel Cormier. Volkov absolutely blasted Derek Lewis, completely beat him up and nearly finished him at several points. And Derek Lewis, tired as he was still able to inflict his hard-hitting offense. So we've seen Derek Lewis struggle and return and win. He's always dangerous, and he's incredibly difficult to finish. He is always going to be a threat until the fight is called off. And even though I do think Daniel Cormier is going to win this fight, Derek Lewis can absolutely kind of make history here and become the new champ.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be the question. Is there anybody out there outside of the people inside Derek Lewis camp that is predicting him to win this fight? It should be noted, he does have a 7-inch reach advantage in this fight. And as of doing this show here on Wednesday morning, Daniel Cormier, a 7-1 favorite. Derek Lewis, a 5-1 underdog. If you're looking at some of those prop bets, if you want to go, say, Cormier by submission, plus 175. Cormier wins by TKO or KO is minus 165. Now, if you want to double down and you say Derek Lewis is going to win this fight, he's going to win this fight by knockout, you can get that at plus 720. But look, I think we're going to see Daniel Cormier retain the title. And then, we'll probably, I think the interesting part is will Brock Lesnar be in attendance on Saturday night, which I know the WWE is still doing their event over in Saudi Arabia on Friday. So I don't know. Is Brock part of that?
Yes, he is. If Brock Lesnar makes it there, I don't know how airplanes work. I don't know how it works to go from Saudi Arabia to America. But, man, if he makes it to the UFC, that is going to be one pissed off Brock Lesnar. The fact that he took a red eye, because it is Friday in Saudi Arabia. I think it's like during the like our daytime when we wake up. But yeah, he's challenging for the WWE title, so he's going to be the last match on the show. But yeah, I mean, if you were watching WWE programming for the last 4 weeks, you would never know where the event takes place. Because I swear to God, Jason, I swear to God, ever since the whole controversy went down, where like the, you know, the dude got murdered in the Saudi Arabian consulate, and there was a lot of public pressure for the WWE to take away the show, they have not uttered the two words Saudi Arabia on their TV or in their commercial ads.
Here's, and I know Luke Thomas, I've mentioned this on a SiriusXM show, but I do wonder, would the reaction be exactly the same if this was a UFC event?
In Saudi Arabia?
Yeah. Because, I mean, look, there's a lot of pressure on WWE to not do this event, obviously. And from a business understanding, I get the financial aspects of why they're doing it. I get that. But from a public relations aspect, I have no idea why they're doing that event.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the money, man. It's the money, man. I mean, you follow the money. It's like they are making more money on these. Well, not making more money because they spend a whole hell of a lot. Like the profit isn't great, but the gross is huge, like absolutely huge compared to any other show they do other than maybe WrestleMania, which is like, wow. And this is like a 10-year deal. So that's why the money's so good. Man, if the UFC were to do something similar, I think the show gets canceled. I really do. Based on the fact that with the UFC, I feel like the public pressure would have been more louder from within. An interesting dichotomy is the UFC, it does feel like fighters have more freedom to talk crap about the promotion. Whereas with the WWE, it's like everyone's been pretty silent. Even though I'm pretty sure people on that roster have a very, very strong opinions about not going there, that hasn't been made publicly clear other than like a guy in John Cena pulling out, but he did that just – he pulled out, but he didn't make any comments bashing the WWE. Whereas, man, if the UFC went to Saudi Arabia and they booked some fighters in the card that didn't want to be there, I think they would have taken to Twitter to voice their displeasure. That's the difference between the UFC and the WWE.
No, that's a – that's a great point that you mentioned. But back to the UFC 230 fight card. Co-main event, of course, initially was supposed to be Chris Weidman, Luke Rockhold. However, it is Chris Weidman versus Jacare Souza. David Branch now taking on Jared Cannonier, which, I mean, look, should be a pretty easy win there by David Branch, even though David Branch only minus 360 on the betting lines. I am kind of shocked. Shock's not the right word. Surprised to see Jacare is the underdog against Chris Weidman, because at this point I don't have a lot of confidence in Chris Weidman.
I can certainly see why you say that, and you know, I'm kind of bummed out that we're not getting Rockhold Weidman, but I think the reason why you look at Jacare and he's a slight dog against Chris Weidman is the fact that he's coming off that loss to Kelvin Gastelum, and is the fact that both him and Weidman are kind of in this weird point in their careers where I think we've seen them at their absolute best, and we've seen them look pretty bad, and now we understand that they're probably in a happy medium. So if you feel pretty confident about Jacare Souza, you can think back to the way Weidman looked in that stretch from the Rockhold loss to the Romero loss to the Musasi loss, and you can look at the way Jacare looked in his last couple of fights, even in that loss to Gastelum. But you think back to the way he destroyed Derek Brunson, you're like, damn, I could see why he wins this fight. So I get it. But the push-pull here, and the reason why I think you look at this fight and Jacare is the dog here, is due to how late he took this fight, the short notice aspect of it. In a fight that's pretty close with top middleweights, I think that's a major factor in that Weidman's just had the advantage to prepare for this fight, whereas Jacare is coming in as a replacement for Luke Rockhold, Jason. So I think that's maybe why he's the dog.
But you got to remember, Jacare was already on this card.
Yeah.
He was going to be taking on David Branch. I mean, the thing about Weidman is, let's not forget, it's now been 15 months since we've seen him fight against Kelvin Gastelum, which, yes, he did get the submission win in the third round. But that fight did not go very well for him in the first 10 minutes. Did not go well for him at all. I mean, there was a point that you thought Kelvin Gastelum was going to knock out Chris Weidman, you know, and Weidman survives. I mean, this is a guy in Chris Weidman that is 1-3 in his last four fights. Now, you look at those three losses, they're all against, you know, great fighters and Luke Rockhold, Yoel Romero, and Gegard Mousasi. All those are, you know, fights that he lost via TKO. So I mean, you know, Chris Weidman, you know, if you told me I had to take, you know, I had to place a bet on one of these two guys, no matter what the odds are, I'd probably take Chris Weidman. But I to me, this is more of closer to a pick'em fight than kind of what the betting lines are at right now.
Yeah, well, when you're picking Chris Weidman, it's a picking blind faith because this is a fighter who would look like he was going to take over the middleweight division and run with it back in 2013. And the last time he's looked like that guy was May 2015 when he took on Vitor Belfort. That's the last time Chris Weidman looked like the freaking best middleweight in the world. So from that point forward, it's been pitfall. It's been failure. And often in the history of MMA, guys who have incredible peaks and then falter, they don't usually return to that form. We constantly kind of pick them to do so, but they never really do. They never really recapture it. So that's where there's a lot of concern for Weidman. And again, you look at this fight and this matchup, and you're like, I could certainly understand maybe Weidman controlling the wrestling. But if he does control the wrestling, what happens there? Is he really going to get the better of freaking a guy like Jacare on the ground? The answer is no. The answer is on the ground, Jacare is going to toll him. So you start to analyze what goes on when the fight gets started. And you look at the aspect of the stand-up, you look at the aspect of the grappling. I think the stand-up's closer, but I almost even look at Jacare and think of some of the explosive actions. And I think this is a guy who's going to dominate the aspects of the fight where it's explosive, where finishes are likely impossible. I think you tell me there's a finish, I think I tell you Jacare wins this fight. I think you tell me there's a split decision, I think I tell you Chris Weidman wins that fight. And even though I understand why Jacare is a slight underdog, I still am picking him in this fight. But if you're the UFC, I do think you want to be in the Chris Weidman business, and you do hope that he kind of revitalizes his career, because when this guy was going on his run as middleweight champion, man, there was a lot of potential there, both as a fighter and as a star. Just him coming out to Tom Petty, won't back down, taking on Silva and Machida and Belfort. I think that's what the UFC wants to return to, but I think this fight against Souza, Jason, is going to be Chris Weidman's fourth loss in five fights.
Something to notice about, to mention about UFC 230, and particularly the main card on pay-per-view, outside of the main event, all the other fights are middleweight fights. So we got, you know, Branch and Jared Cannonier. I think the expectation, David Branch should win that fight. But, you know, Cannonier taking that fight on short notice maybe comes in and shocks the world. We got Carl Roberson taking on Jack Marshman, kind of, you know, one of those fights that, in a way, you know, you have two guys coming in off losses, but you kind of feels like maybe the UFC maybe a little more invested in Carl Roberson. And then you got Brunson and Adesanya, which is a fight you mentioned earlier. To me, this is my number two fight on this fight card. I love this matchup. I think it's going to be a fun fight. Great way to kick off the main card. Israel Adesanya -320 on the betting lines. Derek Brunson +260. Man, that Derek Brunson +260, that's a nice little line if you're looking to play an underdog on Saturday.
Oh, man, Derek Brunson could absolutely play the role of spoiler against Israel Adesanya. I mean, man, when you look at Brunson in the UFC lately, man, the one word that comes to mind is range. There is a wide range of Derek Brunsons that could come to play. There's the Derek Brunson that comes out and knocks you out in 60 seconds. There's the Derek Brunson that looks like he doesn't know what he's doing against Robert Whittaker. You never really know. And when you have that type of wide range and you have an underdog in that situation, that's when there's potential for him to play the role of spoiler. Man, Israel Adesanya, though, I mean, there's a reason why he was so high on your cut list, because in his three UFC fights, he has really displayed his high level of potential. But he hasn't necessarily gone out there and aced the test against a top fighter like Derek Brunson. Brad Tavares was pretty good, but I would still put him at a slight step lower. Adesanya looked great against Brad Tavares, and I think there's potential for him to look great against Derek Brunson. But you're right in that Derek Brunson is a live dog in this fight. I still like Israel Adesanya a whole lot. I mean, if we look at these four middleweight fights and we just pretend they're like some kind of tournament bracket, I would say Israel Adesanya would be my pick to win the whole tournament if it was like a PFL tournament. I think Weidman and Souza would obviously be the favorite. But I think Adesanya is the guy who you feel good about fighting three times in a short period of time and wasting through these guys. So Adesanya is my pick in that fight. And then when you look at the other two, middleweight contest. We haven't talked about quite yet. I think the favorites are the clear pick there in Carl Robeson and David Branch.
No, I'm totally with you on there. Now, in terms of the prelims, you've got Jason Knight in the feature matchup. He enters this fight losing three in a row. Of course, been in the UFC since late 2015. He had put together that four-fight winning streak in 2016, early 2017. But things have gone downhill for him since then. Lost for Carl Lamas, Gabriel Benitez, and Marquand Amerikani, taking on Jordan Rinaldi, who also comes in this fight following a loss against Gregor Gillespie. He is 1-2 in the UFC. His only win in the UFC coming against Alvarado Herrera. Should be a nice little fight. You mentioned about Eubanks and Modafari. You have to imagine the winner of this fight, essentially a number one type contender fight. Julio Arce taking on Shaymon Moraes. Also Ben Saunders against Lyman Good. Lyman Good, a 6-1 favorite in that fight. That's your prelim card on FS1. Your Fight Pass prelims. We've got Lando Vannetta against Matt Frivola, Matt Frivola, who trains up in New York, also a local kid here from the Tampa area. You got Shane Burgos versus Kurt Hollebaugh. That's definitely a fight that has my interest. Brian Kelleher versus Montel Jackson. Of course, you're going to hear from Montel Jackson here in a little bit. And also, you got the heavyweights kicking off the fight card, which something note about Marcos Rogério de Lima. This is his first fight since coming off USADA suspension, and his manager, Alex Davis, wrote this article on MMAJunkie.com where, Lima has gone through drug testing by USADA, but the New York Commission actually is requiring another drug test that he has to pay for. And I look at that, and I'm just like, really? He needs to pay for his own drug test, even though he's been drug tested now three times by USADA leading up to this fight?
That's kind of crazy to me. I mean, the biggest thing is the expense. The expense of the individual getting tested, I think, is kind of uncalled for. So that's kind of nuts. Yeah, I mean, this isn't a sport of rich people.
Yeah, and this is what Alex Davis wrote. He wrote, Marco received notice he will still need to submit another surprise test this week to the New York State Athletic Commission, and it's at his expense. We find this completely unfair. It's not about the cost of the exam. It's about the principle. Why is it that Marco has to add burden to what has been an already very difficult period in his life? It seems the New York Commission accepted USADA's first test results that show the PEDs. Why doesn't it accept USADA's further investigation and subsequent results? And why does it accept the results of Marco's later tests? I wonder if the commission members even took to inquire. Probably not. And, I mean, look, you understand what Alex Davis is saying.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal way of framing it. The fact that you utilize USADA to punish him and you don't look at the results, the positive results, to reinstate him. It's like you use this institution to decide whether or not he can fight in your state. And it just seems like they're being difficult, which is the name of the game when it comes to the New York State Athletic Commission. I mean, every time the UFC does an event in New York, there's all kinds of malarkey that goes on, and I assume that'll be the case after UFC 230. Like I'm just saying this now. I know for a fact we're going to be talking about UFC 230 and the NYSAC do something stupid. They never don't. I mean, they are really – when they made that athletic commission, I'm sure they had the Texas commission. It's like, we want to be just like them, and they're doing it.
Yeah, it's it all goes down on Saturday night. I'll be watching these fights via DVR, because I'll be up in Charlotte, North Carolina. But you know what's entertaining about watching the fights is when you can place a little action on it. Guys, you've heard us talking about my bookie for several weeks, and some of you are still on the sideline. Whether you're an expert or rookie, you should be betting at my bookie. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, like playing the numbers on roulette, you can create a big parlay. There's so much to bet on, along with placing your bets on Saturday's UFC 230. Maybe you want to place a bet on Daniel Cormier. Maybe you want to place a bet on Chris Weidman. You can also make bets on football, basketball, and hockey. My bookie is the one bet I know you'll be happy with all year.
I recommend these guys because I really trust them. My bookie has been in business for years. They've got online great online reviews, and their mobile site is so easy to use. And backed by popular demand, MyBookie will offer a 100% bonus for one more week this year. That's right. Have you been thinking about placing a pick all season but have it manned up? Well, it's time for you to make your move. After Sunday's kickoff, you can kiss that bonus goodbye. Also, make sure to follow BetMyBookie at BetMyBookie on Twitter or Instagram. Again, it's at BetMyBookie. Follow them on Twitter and Instagram, and they will personally respond to every mention and DM, not to mention that they've given away nearly $10,000 in free money to their followers this football season. You'll be the first to know as soon as new odds and props are posted.
So all you gotta do is log on to MyBookie right now. Don't miss out on your last opportunity to collect the industry's biggest bonus. All you gotta do is use our promo code MMAREPORT, MMAREPORT, and you'll get your first deposit match 100%. You hear that, guys? They're gonna match your first deposit 100%. That's promo code MMAREPORT. You play, you win, you get paid. So if you're looking to place a bet on UFC 230, you need to check out our friends over at MyBookie and make sure you use our promo code MMAREPORT so they know you heard about them here on the MMA Report podcast. But now coming up here on the podcast is going to be the interview portion of the show. Up first, you're going to hear my conversation with Tyson Chartier, the man behind Top Game Management, along with being a manager. He's also a coach, works with guys like Rob Font, Calvin Kattar, Andre Sukumthaw, other guys. So you hear my conversation with him. We talk about the coaching industry, the management industry, and other things going on in MMA. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Montel Jackson. And, of course, he's going to be taking on Brian Kelleher on the UFC Fight Pass prelims of UFC 230 on Saturday night. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Anthony Romero, who's got a fight coming up in the King of the Cage. So up first is my conversation with Tyson Chartier. Joining me now here on the MMA Report podcast is the man behind Top Game Management, coach, manager, kind of has a bunch of titles in terms of MMA, Tyson Chartier. Tyson, man, I really appreciate the time. Of course, we've had a bunch of your guys here on the podcast over the past couple of years. You had that trip over in Canada. A great night for you, 2-0. Calvin gets a win. Andre gets a win. Had Andre on the show last week, and it was really interesting talking to Andre and kind of after everything that happened, you know, earlier this year and now what happened, splitting his camp between Rhode Island. But for you, I mean, how would you describe your job? I mean, is it part-time manager, part-time coach? How do you view it?
I'm not part-time anything. I'm like full-time. If you ask my wife, she'll say I'm full-time everything. I'm like a coach agent where I'm a coach. I would say like I'm Calvin Kattar and Rob Font's head coach. So I run their camps. And then with that comes bringing in a lot of different training partners that I end up coaching on the side. So you could say like I'm an assistant coach to a lot of other guys. But I run their camps. And then, you know, I run Top Game Management along with, you know, Ed Cap. And we got roughly 30 athletes and, so I put a lot of time into that as well. But, I'm obviously like a player coach. I'm a dual role. I'm just honestly just whatever it takes. If I have to carry dirty laundry on fight week, I'll do that. If I have to, you know, have conference calls and work deals on the sponsorship side, I'll do that. But it's really just whatever needs to get done, I get done. And, obviously we're a small staff and just, I guess you could say the mission statement or the goal behind everything I do is, you know, what did I not get when I was fighting or what did I wish I had? And I just do that.
Yeah, speaking of your fighting career, you mentioned about Ed Cap. He sent me a video of you and Nate Andrews from back in your amateur days. You got the submission win there. Of course, Nate, people know him from, CES. What do you remember about that fight?
All I think back on that is I got Nate at the right time. He was only 2-0 and I was 6-0. And, you know, I got the finish, but honestly, Nate is a beast. In my eyes, he's the best 55er right now that's not in the UFC. I really think we're a victim of our own success at this point because he's 14-1. So if a late injury happens, and he's got 14 finishes, if a late injury happens, there's not too many people, you know, when Sean Shelby reaches out that are going to choose Nate over anybody else they offer. I know if I was offered someone like, a 6-0 guy or a 14-1 guy with 14 finishes, I'm not going to choose the 14-1 guy. And especially he's, you know, 6 feet tall. He's a southpaw. So he's a tough matchup for anybody at 55. I see him in the gym with UFC fighters and he does really, really well. He's sparring with Cowboy the last couple of weeks up here in New England and, you know, he holds his own and like he belongs in the UFC. It's like a sore point of mine that he's not there yet. He deserves to be there. You know, that It'll just be cool when he finally gets there and gets that hand raised, then I'll be able to say, all right, I beat him, like, jokingly. But I know my skill set was never near what his is now. I just caught him at the right time. I was a little older than him. I caught him early in his career, and then that would definitely be a feather in my cap and something I'm obviously really proud of. But, you know, I want nothing but the best for that guy now. It's just cool to be now on the management side, helping him out and helping him get there. So he's an awesome dude too. You know, he's a fellow father. He's got a young son. He's awesome. He's always spending time with him. So it's good to see, like, good people doing good things, whether or not they were ever my former opponent or not.
You mentioned about your wife, and anyone who follows you on Instagram, they'll see a lot of pictures of your wife and your children and how supportive she is as someone who operates his own business. I know you got to have the wife on board with everything you're doing. And I got to imagine for you, that's got to be the biggest thing is having her there, knowing of the amount of hours you put into your business.
Man, she's the co-pilot. It's amazing how much she sacrifices, you know, when I travel. You know, I just went to Canada for a week. I'm going to Argentina for 5 days in a couple weeks here. And then I'm going out to Vegas the end of November. And then I'm going to be in Milwaukee for a week. And, you know, she's running the everything back here. You know, we got the two kids. We got Cameron, who'll be 3 in December. Lawson, who's 9 months old. And she's doing everything. She's the mom and the dad when I'm gone. You know, I get to FaceTime a little bit, but she's running the ship. So without her, there is no Top Game. There is no Coach Tyson. Like, there is none of that, because she has to be all in. And, you know, Greg Abello always jokes around. He's like, where's my real manager? Put her on the phone. And to be truth be told, she gets it too. Like, she'll watch a fight, or she'll see a matchup, or she'll hear me on a conference call and I'll have it on mute. And she already knows the answer I'm going to say. Like, she understands the business side of it. She understands the coaching side of it. She'll text me during fights and be like, that was stupid. Why did that kid go to mount? That was dumb. Like, she gets it, man. She's, you know, I'm super blessed that I have her, and without her, there is none of this, you know. So it's, I'm really lucky in that aspect.
And you got a big weekend coming up here, CES. You've got two guys on that one, and also on Saturday, Peter Barrett. Unfortunately, couldn't fight back in Bellator, as I previously reported. His opponent failed his drug test, so that fight didn't happen. I mean, is that kind of one of the worst conversations for you to have a fighter, to call him up and say, hey, man, your fight's not happening?
Not. I mean, obviously, anytime a fight doesn't happen, it stinks, and you try to hide it from him for a couple of days until you have a solution. I'd rather call him with information that the problem's fixed. Hey, there's this problem, but I fixed it, or we fixed it, or whatever. But, you know, he was taking that fight. You know, it was a change of venue for him. Obviously, he's 1-3 in his last four. He's fallen on some hard times after starting out 8-9-0. And he's just such a nice kid, talented kid. So, obviously, the fight that we have next week is more of a grudge match type fight with Keegan. You know, they seem to have a little bit of bad blood. I don't know whether it's manufactured or they really don't like each other. But it gets him a payday. It gets him some ring time. It gets him in the cage. Hopefully improves his record. And he gets to work on some things. And I think that's better than not fighting, you know. So a couple of people ask me, hey, why are you doing that matchup? And at the end of the day, like, these guys love fighting. You know, he gets to go in there and have a fist fight on Saturday night, and he gets to get paid for it. And all his friends and family, because he sells a lot of tickets, they get to see him fight. So at the end of the day, like, whether or not it makes sense on paper, this resume versus that resume, like, sometimes you just have to throw that all out the window and say, hey, listen, Pete wants to fight. He likes fighting. He's going to go in there Saturday night. He's going to put his hands on someone and not let them put their hands on him. And, you know, that's really what it is for this one Saturday. Now, I'm excited for that. For a little bit of a grudge match, some bad blood. You know, Keegan's put up a couple posts on Facebook about he wants to put his elbow through his face and stuff like that. And it's all in good fun, man. Like, I'm sure after the fight's over, win, lose, or draw, both sides, they're gonna hug it out. And, I manage Devin, who's one of Keegan's coaches, and we're talking about the matchup while we do strength and conditioning together. So, I mean, at the end of the day, this is a sport. These people are in there. They might have some bad blood, but more than not, after the fight, they're going to hug it out and then probably have a beer together. So, and then Friday night, I'm excited, man. Right when Dennis lost to Ewell that last fight, he was winning the fight, and, you know, he just made one mistake. He shot him without setting it up, and he exposed his neck. And, you know, he's worked on that since then. He's changed some things up. Right when that fight happened, and then we started talking about booking him again, I got on the phone with Pat Sullivan from CS. I said, listen, we need to fight for the belt again. Ewell just got signed to Barão. He's going to go to Brazil, and he's going to beat him. I figured he would beat Barão, and he did. You know, there's no reason that Dennis doesn't deserve an immediate title shot again against whoever the next guy is. And he's fought for CES more than anyone else has. He's got a good record with them. And coming off the performance that he came off of, and then Yule turn around and getting signed with the UFC, it just made sense. And I think there's, you know, there's case studies for that. You know, the UFC's done that a bunch of times, guys coming off losses and then getting immediate rematch. So, you know, I'm really excited for Dennis. Like, I just want to see him get that belt put around his waist. I know he'll cry. It'll be emotional for everybody. And he's just such a good guy. And to see him get his hand raised and get that belt put around his waist, it'd just be, it'd be kind of extremely rewarding from a selfish standpoint on my end, because I just want to see what, you know, I'll feel accomplished for him, you know, and it'd just be so happy for him. And you couldn't obviously have a better person. He's a great training partner for everybody. He's super appreciative. You know, he's one of the athletes that after a fight, when lose a draw, he sends you that text message like, "Hey man, I just wanted to thank you. Everything you do for me, it doesn't go unnoticed. And, you know, I really appreciate you." And those things go a long way. So I'm excited for him.
You mentioned about Greg Rebello, of course, a short-lived retirement. When I talked to him, he said it was about a day or two later that he realized he didn't want to call a career. He recently told me 2019 is when he's looking to get back in there. I mean, have you and CES started talking about a date yet?
Yeah, I think – I don't know if CES has announced their MMA date for January, so I can't say that. But we're trying to get him on the January card. I mean, it probably doesn't make sense for the other side, but we were asking for Josh Parisian to come back in and fight us in January. So I asked for that fight. Honestly, it probably doesn't make sense for their end. And Josh is a great kid. And, you know, Maurice was on the Ultimate Fighter with him, and he just says can say nothing bad about the kid. And even when me and Greg saw Josh in Vegas before the fight, he's just nothing but class. But that's a fight Greg would love back. So if they're interested in it and Josh wants to come and try to fight for that title, you know, that's something we're down. We'll make it work financially, like whatever we need to do. Greg wants that rematch. He wants to get back in there and perform how he knows he can perform. Like, CS is Greg's home. You know, he's kind of a little cursed in that Ultimate Fight House gym. He's 0-3. But in the CES cage, there's not too many heavyweights that can take it to Greg.
Yeah, yeah. And Greg, anyone who knows him knows how much he loves to rib on people. You know, I got him back the other day when my Magic beat his Celtics. So it was nice to kind of get one in on Greg there. But you mentioned Maurice Greene, Ultimate Fighter. Is it kind of weird for you to watch him on TV where he was gone for 6 weeks?
It is weird because he's just such a goofball. Like, he's just funny. Like, you know, they kind of portray him as being like a little bit of an alcoholic on the show or whatever. And he's just nothing but a family man. He's just a cool guy. You know, he's got his two little kids. He's just awesome. You know, the whole time he was out there, me and his wife were texting, just, you know, checking in on each other, you know, seeing how she's doing and following up a couple things. And, you know, it's just surreal to see, you know, see him on TV versus the Mo I know. And obviously it's a little bit of reality TV, so how they portray him isn't necessarily how he really is. But, you know, I'm excited for Maurice. You know, he trains at the Star PJJ Minnesota out in Minnesota in St. Cloud with Brock Larson, who's one of the best guys you could ever know in MMA. And he trains at me, Brock, and Tony Martin own that gym out there. And he trains there, and he's just an awesome teammate. He's always promoting the gym. Super nice guy. Yeah, I'm excited for, you know, we can't talk about what he's doing, but, you know, I'm excited for what the future holds for him.
Is that the hardest thing for you when you have a guy on a reality show that it's like, okay, I can't say anything? Because I remember knowing somebody back in the day went on, and I believe it was $5 million was a penalty if you leaked any of the information.
Yeah, I mean, if it was $10, at the end of the day, you just don't want to upset the UFC or the production team for the Ultimate Fighter. So you just keep it under wraps. You know, there's a very tight circle of people who will be in the know of what's going on and planning for the next move. But it's just part of the process. It's exciting, and it's not that long that you can't say anything. Obviously it'll get announced soon enough. And then people will know, but no, everybody around us is pretty professional. They don't pry. They kind of know the drill.
Of course, you also got Pam Sorensen fighting for the Invicta title coming up. Also, maybe a little known fact people don't know about you, you're also a certified NFL agent. So what made you decide to go through the certification for that?
Well, originally the plan with that was when I was partnered with another agency for a little while, and they were going to the NFL space. So it made sense. I'd be East Coast, they'd be West Coast. And then, you know, we went separate ways. So I still went through with getting certified. It was more of just a bucket list thing for me. You know, they said like 70% of the people fail the test in the first year. So I was like, no, I'm going to go knock this test out. And I did it, and I did pass. It was more of like a bucket list thing and a way to differentiate myself from other MMA agents. Because as you know, in MMA, it's the Wild West. Like you right now, Jason, you could become an agent.
And then yeah.
manage someone. But what's the difference between you and someone else? Like, so the fact that I went through the NFL testing means they've done a background check. They've done a financial background check. They've done, you know, all the credit checks, all the reference checks, all that stuff. Everything checks out. So if I have the accreditation to become an NFL test, number one, I'm not an idiot because I passed the test. And number two is, you know, I'm not like a scumbag. I don't owe people money. I have a good credit history. I don't have a criminal past. So it's a little bit of a differentiator. If you're trying to sign a new client on the MMA side, I can use that as just a differentiator between like, hey, listen, at least you know you're getting into business with someone who doesn't owe someone money. So that was really it. I didn't really follow up with it much once that happened. And I started really like focusing full time on, because as that happened, then a couple of the guys changed camps and I became the head coach. It was just all in on the coaching side. So I didn't really have much time on the NFL side. So I kind of just let it fall by the wayside. But it was really just a bucket list thing. I could say I did it. And a little bit of a differentiator in terms of how to, I guess you could say, set myself aside from other agents in MMA.
And one of the things I love about your Instagram, you'll do this every once in a while where you like put a little picture out of your scouting report when, you know, you've got like, say, Rob's fighting somebody. You'll start going through all of that. And I find that very interesting because I see how football teams do it. And to see how you do it, I mean, are we talking that packet's like 50 pages long?
No, it's not 50 pages. It's 50 hours long. But no, really, like this goes back to like what I said at the beginning is I try to do for these guys what I wish I had done for myself when I fought. You know, I was kind of my own head, not my own head. I had good coaches. I had Chris Owen and John Johnson who were in my corner every time I fought. And those guys were great. But, you know, John was running a team. Chris was my jiu-jitsu coach. And, you know, it was kind of back in the Wild West when there wasn't a lot of structure in MMA. So they did what they knew. And little by little, I was cornering all the other guys with them, all my teammates like Rob and all those guys. And then I was just like, well, once I became more of a coach and stopped fighting, I was like, well, what can I do to help these guys win fights? And really it was put pen to paper, start watching video. I'm a big like video nerd in terms of looking for tendencies, looking for strengths, looking for weaknesses, and figuring out like, okay, what sandbox can we play in where we have the best percentage of winning? And then just structuring it. It's an evolving template that, you know, every fight we might add something or take something away, but really it's just from a high level. It's just, you know, in New England, we don't have a mega camp. You know, we're one little family in New England and we get a cross train at several different gyms. So how do we get all the coaches on the same page? You know, how do I get the jiu-jitsu coach and the boxing coach working on the same stuff? You know, I don't want a boxing coach working on big overhand rights when we're trying to stay low and long and throw straight punches. And the wrestling coach needs to know what we're working on. Like, you know, he's working on takedowns versus, you know, get ups if we're thinking about being on the top in the fight. It's just a way to organize the camp, structure everything so all the coaches are on the same page and then all the sparring partners know what to mimic, because that's important too. So really it's just putting all the videos down, going over like film notes, putting down strengths, weaknesses, and then tendencies from different positions, and then putting together like a strategy of like, hey, how are we going to win this fight? Like, what's our plan A, then a plan B, and then a plan C of, you know, if we're looking to keep the fight standing. Obviously with, you know, with Calvin's last fight, we were fighting wrestlers, but really the idea was low and long, only straight punches, throw the right hand while aiming low because we knew he was going to come in and stay low. And obviously, you know, it worked out. One second. Obviously it worked out, but you know, we had plans for every position that we were going to be on the ground. And then, you know, I was able to, you know, Carlos Nettle worked a lot on guillotine escapes. You saw he got right out of the guillotine there. Guillotine escapes, defending against leg locks, you know, and then get ups off the ground and stuff like that. You know, my role in terms of coaching the camp was really to like get him up off the ground, get him up off the, you know, if he took us down off the fence. And then Greg Ravello was there for, you know, what type of combinations are we going to use on the feet? Are we going to adjust our stance to be a little bit lower because we're going to be ready for it? And then as the head coach, it's making sure that all these guys are on the same page. Like, I'm not, Greg Ravello can teach striking way better than I can. You know, and I know that. So I believe in Greg for that. And then me and Greg will on the side talk about like what type of things we think, you know, what we should call them. You know, we have call signs for different combinations and, you know, what things we should work on during camp to make sure that Calvin's on the same page with it. And obviously Calvin's a different fighter than Rob. So you gotta coach him a little bit differently. But really, I mean, you know, everything we worked on in the game plan and everything the coaches worked on it really did come together on fight night. You know, you saw Calvin keep his feet underneath him. He wasn't throwing big overhand bombs. He was throwing, the punch he knocked him out with was one of our call sign combos. We, you know, I'm not going to say the name of it, but, you know, we call out a certain code and he steps in with a 1-2. And for this fight, we had to adjust the two to be a little bit lower because the guy was shorter and he's a wrestler. You know, and Joe Lozano will always preach anytime you're fighting a wrestler, aim towards the chest with the right hand. And, you know, we made those adjustments. So that call sign was slightly different for this fight. And that's what he knocked him out with. It was great. So it's great when a plan comes together because you look like a genius. But when it doesn't work, then you get blamed.
You know, and we'll leave on this note. I mean, one of the things I love about UFC.TV, when you order a pay-per-views there, is you can listen to the corner audio. And as you were talking there, maybe kind of think, don't you have to kind of change your calls every fight just in case the other camp is going back and listening to what your audio from the corner was?
Yeah, you do call, you know, you have like, you'll have call signs for different combos, but honestly, dude, I don't even think half these other coaches watch video. I think they watch like maybe one or two videos they get in there. Like, I know, I just think that the MMA, especially coaching, isn't on the same level as obviously an NFL. Like, there's a lot of structure to that. We're still figuring this stuff out. Like, you couldn't tell me right now what's the best camp. Is it ATT with the mega camp feel at Jackson's? You know, is it the boutique camps, like, you know, kind of like a Mighty Mouse has? Is it what we're doing in New England with involving 7-8 different schools and coaches and opinions? I don't think anybody knows. So it's evolving. So we're trying to figure out the best way to make it work. But one thing I'll say is I don't think the level of coaching in MMA is as professional as the other major sports yet. The barrier to entry is lower. You can have one great athlete and you can be a horrible coach and you still look like a genius, or you can be a great coach with horrible athletes and look like an idiot. So I don't think a lot of these other coaches are really studying the film like me and some others are, and really, like, you know, because I do study what the other right now we're working on, you know, Sergio Pettis' game plan, and we have a good idea of what we're going to do. But I know he works, you know, what wrestling coaches he works with, and I know their tendencies. I know what's, you know, he's obviously with Duke Rufus, and, you know, we're looking at different things, and I'm trying to figure those things out. You know, so they'll probably come up with new call signs for their stuff because they know that I'm going to know what they are. And, but I do agree, like, if they were smart, they'd read it. But, you know, we do make changes every fight, especially if it's like a pretty obvious thing, like, that we call out and then he does it. But I don't really think anything that we did last fight, they would even know what we called out.
And, of course, if anybody wants to follow you on social media, kind of get it into your world, into the Top Game Management world, how can they find you?
It's just Tyson_Chartier on Instagram. And I'm pretty – my guys don't post as much as I'd like them to sometimes. So with Rob and Calvin, you know, Rob's in camp right now. You know, I'm at a lot of his training sessions, and I'm pretty good at updating my stories. So you can kind of see what they're doing in training and strength and conditioning. And then obviously put up some pictures on Instagram and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm pretty accessible through there. And then I back up everything on Facebook. So that's pretty much the best way to get hold of me.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that's going to have his second fight in the UFC, UFC 230s. He takes on Brian Kelleher. It is Montel Jackson. Montel, I appreciate the time. Unfortunately, unable to get the win in your official UFC debut. I think even though most of us would probably look at the Contender Series really as your UFC debut. But as you think about that experience, what was the biggest takeaway from you from that fight? And is UFC jitters for real? Is that a real thing?
No. That stuff isn't real, man. The biggest thing I could take away from that from my first fight in the official fight in the UFC is that you got to be prepared for the opportunities when they present itself. You know, a lot of guys, they always say, I want the chance, I want the opportunity. But it really comes down to, are you truly prepared for the opportunity when it presents itself? Are you there? Are you there willing and ready to seize that opportunity when it's given to you or presented to you? So that's one of the biggest things I took away from that fight, is to be prepared for the opportunity when it presents itself.
And now you've got Brian Kelleher here. You know, Brian obviously has had some notable fights and some notable wins throughout his career. You know, when you first get the phone call, Brian Kelleher, what do you think about this matchup? Do you remember, was there an initial thought that you had when your manager, you know, told you what the fight offer was?
Oh, man, it's the same as always, man. It's another fight, man. Let's do it. Let's work. We ready to work. Let's go.
As you have prepared for this matchup, is there something that stuck out to you about Brian that you're like, man, you know, he does this really well. This is something that I know I have to look out for on fight night.
No, man. I don't watch tape. I don't do that stuff, man. I don't fall into that stuff. You know, who cares what he's good at? You know, just like he could tell you, he might tell you who cares what I'm good at. You know, that stuff is not important. I'm going in there with the mindset and the willingness to impose my will on him, you know? So whatever he's good at, I truly don't care for anybody or any opponent. That's why I don't watch tape or study that stuff or, you know, all that stuff. That's just crazy, man. That stuff is, to me, that stuff is nothing other than a sign of insecurity and weakness, you know? That's mental weakness, you know?
Has that always been your mindset, or is it or was there, you know, something that happened as you early on in your career that you just realized that, hey, man, I just need to worry about myself and not worry about my opponent?
Man, when I wrestled in high school in the wrestling tournaments, you know, like, that was the attitude. Don't care who's in your bracket. That don't matter. That truly don't matter. You got to go out and you got to wrestle your match. You got to wrestle your way. So I take that same mindset into the fight business, you know. Who cares what they're good at? Who cares who's in my weight class? Who cares who I'm matched up against? It don't matter. I'm going out there to do my thing. You know, I can care less about, like, you know, worrying about what this guy is good at or what he does or who this guy is. That stuff is not important to me.
Now, in your wrestling days, would you look at that bracket and go, man, I hope this guy makes it to me because I want to test my abilities against that guy?
No, I didn't care, man. I didn't truly care, man. Like, whoever, whenever. That don't make no difference. Like, I truly didn't care. Like, I didn't, when you're great or when you're the best, people will find you. There's no need for you to find them. So, like, your talent and your work history is going to speak for itself. So all that looking for a challenge and going to find guys, they will find you. Don't worry. There's always somebody out there watching you. There's always somebody out there preparing to beat you. So that stuff is not important. That's, like, the least of my worries.
How would you say you're a different fighter now as opposed to the last time we saw you in action?
I don't know, man. That's up to you guys, you know. That's like, everybody's opinion is going to differ. It depends on what you define as different for me now and then, you know. I don't know. I can't tell you. I'll leave that up to the person, you know. You know what they say, beauty's an eye of the beholder. So I leave that stuff all up to people, man. I don't worry about that stuff.
And one of the things I always talk about is perception and realities are two different things, particularly in the fight game. What do you think is the biggest perception about a fighter in general that just is nowhere near reality?
The biggest perception that people have about fighters are, like, fighters are dumb. They're not smart. Like what guy wants to get punched in the face for a living? Like, it's like that type of cliche. And, like, people don't really understand, like, fighters are actual human beings, and a lot of us are capable and willing to have and do, you know, regular jobs and work regular jobs and careers, but, you know, we wasn't afraid. We were what you call risk takers, you know. We bet on ourselves, you know. We put everything into this, you know, to get that big reward. So, of course, like, I can go out and get a regular job and work a full-time job, working 40 hours, making someone else's dream come true, but that's no life, you know. You know what they always say, I'm here for a good time, not a long time.
Now, if you were not a fighter, what do you think that job would be?
I'd probably be a civil engineer. That's the job I would probably have. Or I would be a teacher or a social worker of some sort.
Now, was that something growing up that you kind of saw yourself doing? Or kind of as you aged on, you kind of, those would have been the other path you would have gone down?
Yeah, it was going to be one of those three things. A civil engineer, a teacher, or a social worker. Those are the three things that... that really interested me the most. And the most of my adulthood has just been dedicated to this fighting, you know, no partying, no crazy stuff. Just this, you know, focus on this, you know, chasing my dream, you know. Like, I wasn't in school, I was going to college and stuff. I stopped going, you know, to do this. So this is all I got, and that's what I got. And I got, you know, with these two right here, you know. So, as they say, you know, they always tell you, don't put all your eggs in one basket, but, you know, at this point, it's all you got. It's all you can do.
Now, are any of your childhood friends absolutely surprised to know what you do now?
No. Most of them pretty much knew, like I was a fighter, and I was pretty good at fighting. I could always handle myself, and, you know, it was no surprise to them. But, you know, again, like those are the friends that's, you know, alive and, you know, living in the real world, you know. Most of my friends, you know, where I come from, you know, I come from a place where, you know, where everybody want to make it, but nobody, but everybody don't, you know. So most of my friends are, you know, they either dead or they in jail, or, you know, they still living a life that that I'm particularly not living or interested in living anymore. So, yeah, you know, when they see me as love, you know, they always give me shout outs and tell me what's up, always tell me like they're proud of me and that, you know, out of everybody from our projects or our hood that, you know, I made it and, you know, it brings some type of light and joy to their eyes. And hopefully, you know, I'll be a leading example to let the generation coming behind us, let them know and show them that, no, you don't got to perpetuate that cycle of violence and poverty and, you know, doing things to get by for the moment, you know, and it's going to lead you down to a path of destruction, you know. So hopefully, you know, I'll be that shining light for our neighborhood, for the whole city of Milwaukee, for all the underprivileged kids that, you know, that I once was or that look up to me, you know. So I just hopefully, you know, I just work hard, you know, keep my nose to the ground and, you know, do what I can do best, you know, to be that example for those kids, you know, because I once was a kid and I didn't have too many people from my neighborhood that go on and made it to like a big stage, like to the NFL or the NBA or anything like that. Like, that didn't happen. Like, our neighborhood superstars, it wasn't like, like when I grew up, like we didn't look up to like Michael Jordan and stuff like that. Like we looked up to like Big Meech and Frank Lucas and, you know, all the old school, like, you know, like drug dealers and like gangsters and stuff. Cause that stuff was realistic for us. Like we can live that, like we can do that if we wanted to, you know, like make it to the NBA. Like how many guys are going to make it to the NBA? It's like, it's only like it's 30 teams and 15 spots, maybe three reserves. Like how many of us was gonna make it to the NBA? Like, how many of us are gonna make it to the NFL? Like that stuff was, like that stuff became realer and realer as I aged and the people around me aged and I just believed in myself, you know, and I trusted my decisions today that will create and give me a better future for tomorrow.
I remember writing an article in a piece in college about how it's, you know, it was from people who play Division I football that made it to the NFL, it's less than 1% that actually make it there, just kind of, you know, going what you're saying there. You know, Madison Square Garden is a bucket list venue for a lot of fighters, whether we're talking about boxing or mixed martial arts. But do you have your mindset on potentially a short turnaround here in December and fighting in Milwaukee?
Man, anytime, anywhere, man, you know, I'm training every day. Like no days off. So if they call me up with a short notice fight for December 15th in my hometown, like I'm there. I am there 100%. Won't even think twice.
But of course, up first is the fight here against Brian Kelleher, UFC 230 Montel. I really appreciate time. Let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
You can follow me on Instagram at Yo Soy Rapido. You can follow me on Twitter at Montello 145 or 135. And you can follow my fan page on Facebook, Montel Quick Jackson. I want to thank Iridium. I want to thank Virus. I want to thank Combat Corner. I want to thank Pura Vida and my training partners, my coaches. I want to thank Quest Nutrition. I want to thank ProStar Sports. And I want to thank Sweet Sweat.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man we've had on the podcast a couple of times in the past. And he's got another fight coming up here for King of the Cage up in New York on November the 10th. It is Anthony Romero. Looks to go to 4-0 in his career. Anthony, man, as always, I appreciate the time. It's been a couple of weeks since we last talked after that win. What's the last couple of weeks been like for you?
Just training. Training, keep getting better. No rest, really. I feel good. Body feels good. And, just looking forward to the next one. So that would be like in, 2.5 weeks now. So, yeah, I'm excited.
In terms of, evolving, becoming a better martial artist, what do you see the difference in yourself now as opposed to the preparations for your last fight?
Just smarter. Like, I guess it works with my nickname, the genius. Just training smarter. Wrestling is feeling really good, really solid. And then just putting everything together nicely. Just sharper with the strikes, faster with the takedowns. And everything's coming together really well. So.
And looking at your opponent here, Alex Wiggs, 4-3, but you know, you look at his record and then some of the fighters that he's fought. You looked early on in his career, you know, his fourth professional fight was against Bobby Lee, who's now a 9-2 professional. He's coming off a loss against Anthony Gutierrez. I think a lot of people remember Anthony, you know, from his time on The Ultimate Fighter and also there at Titan FC. But, you know, when you think of Alex Wiggs, what really sticks out to you about him?
He's just an aggressive striker. I know he's done some judo. He's a really good opponent. I know it'd be a good matchup for me. And yeah, like always, I respect all my opponents. I never underestimate anyone, especially like you look at his record, 4-3. Just from looking at that, you're like, oh, maybe he's not that good. But I've watched his tape, and I know he's no joke. He's coming out to take my head off. So yeah.
According to Tapology, he was supposed to fight back in June. That fight did happen for whatever reason. So this is actually his first fight since December of last year. Does that make preparations at all a challenge in the fact of the last tape that you and your coaches can find him was from 11 months ago? So he may be a totally different guy at this point.
Yeah, that's true. So that's kind of why I'm trying to get better at my own tools. Just sharpen up and yeah, just gonna go out there, gonna do what I do best is win, and yeah, like from what I can do right now is look at his old tape and yeah, go from there. But other than that, I'm expecting him to be the same fighter, and yeah, that's pretty much it.
Are you and your coaches from the school of thought of, look, this is, while we respect our opponent, this isn't about him, it's about my abilities and what we can do in the fight? Is that kind of your school of thought when you're preparing for a fight of, like, you know, yeah, I'm gonna get and understand what he does, but you know, truly this is about me, and because I have to be thinking about myself and not my opponent?
Yeah, I find that super important, that I focus on myself and not worry too much about what my opponent is going to do to me, because then it kind of freezes me up and yeah, it has me overthink things. And that's not what we want in the middle of a fight. You want no thinking at all, and just rely on instincts.
How tough is that though, to sit there and not kind of overthink things?
It's not tough. Like it sounds like it is, but I practice a lot in my sparring rounds. Just maybe I'm going as a good wrestler. Like just focus on stopping the takedowns and doing what I'm good at, and follow my strengths. So I've been doing it for a while now in the gym, and it'll be no different November 10th.
And of course, another fight for you here for the King of the Cage for, you know, I know people can go to your Facebook page, they can see your last fight, but for those fans who are listening who have never had the opportunity to see you fight, how would you describe who you are as a fighter?
I'm a passionate fighter. I like to be humble. I know McGregor says this, but it's true. I like to be humble in victory and in defeat. I respect my opponents, but I'm there to do work. And yeah, I do my best to be exciting, have the crowd cheering, whether they like me or not. And yeah, just I'm an exciting fighter, I believe. And yeah, that's pretty much it. If you don't know, then you got to come out and get some tickets and come watch November 10th.
Now, of course, that, you know, I always talk about that in terms of the quote unquote regional MMA scene. It's about supporting the fighters, buying tickets for the people up in New York area and want to support you and get tickets from you. How would they do that?
If you're local, then you can get them for myself. If not, you can go on Ticketmaster and get them. The fight will be Salamanca, New York. So if you're in the Niagara region, then it's about an hour away. If you're in Toronto, a little bit farther, but yeah.
I did see on your social media you got tickets for UFC 231 in Toronto. So who do you like in the main event, Holloway or Ortega?
It's a tough one. I like both guys. I love how Ortega is very humble, but he has that goal in mind of becoming a champion. And I like Holloway, but lately he's been unfortunate getting to the fight. So I'm not sure. I would pick Ortega, but I guess we'll find out.
I mean, you know, that's part of the fight game is not wearing your body down to where maybe you don't make it the fight night. I mean, and obviously you're very young in your career, but have you found yourself kind of as time goes on, you just kind of figure out ways to make sure that, you know, you're giving the body the nutrients that you need and recovering it in the correct way?
Yeah, like I'm comfortable making 155. It's pretty easy for me. I've thought about going to 145, but so far I'm doing pretty well at lightweight. So if it's not broken, don't change it. Right. So, yeah, like I'm a professional and I'm doing my best to act like it and make weight and defend an issue. And my hope is that everyone understands that it's a serious issue, but I will be there.
Now, I know in talking to your management, you're actually in between training sessions. So when you're in between training sessions, what do you like to do just to kind of sit back and relax and kind of maybe forget a little bit about the fight game?
Fight camp, it's kind of tough. Like I'll be looking at different fight videos, and me and my coaches will send each other just clips of moves and different things in martial arts. On Instagram, and but if I do have time, I'll play some video games, get my mind in a different world, maybe some TV. But other than that, I'm really focused on fight camp, making sure I'm eating the right meals and getting to my training sessions early, so I have enough time to stretch and get ready properly. So,
you know, you mentioned about it, it's a fairly quick turnaround for you here. You know, it. How would you have say that the kind of the body has reacted for you? Are you kind of, you know, or is it simply of, I'm never in a training camp, I'm just always training?
Yeah, I'm pretty much just always training. My body is always ready for a fight, unless there's something seriously wrong, like a broken bone or something like that. But even then, like if I had a broken arm, I'd find a way to train. Other than that, like my weight's good. I think I said this in the last interview, like I could try to make weight next weekend. And yeah, but like no injuries, knock on wood, and I'm not sick, especially the weather's changing here in Canada. So yeah, everything's perfect so far. So
no, I mean we're in November coming up here. I mean, are you trying to get another fight before 2018 ends after this one? Or is it kind of like, hey, I think maybe I'm going to take a month off, so holidays, spend time with the family, and then get right back into it in 2019?
Well, as of now, like I I'm contracted with King of the Cage, so their next show wouldn't be until February. So I have some time for myself to enjoy the holidays after this fight. Recover, finally, after... Two training camps in a row, and yeah, get back to the next one in February, and then end it off in May. So if all goes well, after May, I would like to get on the contender series and show my talent over there.
Is it one of those things where, I mean, obviously, I mean, as a fighter, you always want to be having fights because, hey, that's when you get paid. We all know that's how this game works. Yeah. But I guess the positive part of that, say, okay, I know I'm going to have 3 months between fights is really those 3 months, or I guess maybe the next 90 days after the fight's over, 6 days after the fight's over, that maybe you can work on your own game a little more than maybe you would when you're actually in quote-unquote fight preparation.
Yeah. It was tough for me to kind of decide on whether I wanted to fight on this day, but I knew like if I waited, then I would have to wait until February, and that would be another long layoff, about five months. Just like my last one, I think my last one was about 8 months. So, and I'm not a very patient person, I guess you could say, when it comes to fighting. So I just want to get in there right away as soon as I can. If I feel good, then that's the best time rather than wait and then have a long camp, get injured, and then have to wait even longer. So if I'm ready, then I might as well just get in there and get it done. I have a board actually in my room where I write all my goals. Unfortunately, there's one left that I couldn't complete, which is the lightweight title. But 4-0. is one of my goals at the end of this year. And then in the new year, I'll be making new goals. So
I got to imagine in the back of your mind, you've already kind of started writing down those 2019 goals, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like the one I just mentioned, the contender series, and then hopefully the UFC by the end of that year. So, yeah.
And of course, the upcoming fight here is November the 10th up in New York, King of the Cage. You can watch Anthony take on Alex Wiggs. Anthony, as always, man, I appreciate the time. Let everyone know they can find you on social media. And if you want to mention your sponsors, the floor is yours, man.
Yeah, thank you. My social media is @GeniusMMA. And some of my sponsors, first of all, my manager, Matthew Dodge from Dodge Sports. It's helped me out a lot with this camp. Cracker Jack Stadium, Phil Suriani, East Main Dental, Blue Star, Never Tap Canada, Rene Romero Nissan, my parents, Rene Romero and Caroline Romero, Miami Mix Media, and Fight Planet. They're a new sponsor of mine. I really appreciate them. They're providing me with gloves and headgear and all the gear that I need. So thank you to Fight Planet.
And there was my conversations with Tyson Chardier, Montel Jackson, and Anthony Romero. Appreciate all those fighters coming on and coach coming on this week's edition of the podcast. Very interesting to hear Tyson talk about the coaching and management game. And, of course, Montel Jackson stepping back inside the UFC cage on Saturday night as he takes on Montel Jackson. Of course, Anthony Romero, a young Canadian lightweight prospect who's looking to go to 4-0 at the upcoming the next weekend's King of the Cage event. So, appreciate all those men coming on the podcast to talk to me about what's going on with them. But before we get into the quote-unquote trade that happened between the UFC and ONE Championships, got to let you know about our friends over at Roman. Guys, you know, we're terrible at taking care of our health, whether it's a knee injury, back injury, or something worse. Guys are usually more comfortable, quote-unquote, rubbing some dirt on it than seeing a doctor. Look, I'm guilty of that myself. I'm not exactly a person that wants to sit there and go to a doctor. You know, I'm a person that, had to get some dental work done. Not exactly something I want to do, but I needed to get it done. But the same is true for erectile dysfunction. Studies show 70% of guys who experience ED don't get treated for it. Thankfully, Roman created an easy way to get checked out by a doctor and get treated for ED online.
Roman is a one-stop shop where licensed U.S. physicians can diagnose ED and ship medication right to your door. With Roman, there are no waiting rooms, no awkward face-to-face conversations, or uncomfortable trips to the pharmacy. You can handle everything discreetly online. All you have to do, guys, is visit GetRoman.com/MMAReport. Visit GetRoman.com/MMAReport. Fill out a brief medical onboarding, chat with a doctor, and get FDA approved ED meds delivered to your door in discreet, unmarked packaging. Guys, go online and get checked by the doctor. Erectile dysfunction is a problem that guys don't tackle, but with Roman, it's really easy. So go take care of it.
And for a free online visit, go to GetRoman.com/MMAReport. That's GetRoman.com/MMAReport for a free online visit. GetRoman.com/MMAReport. And we appreciate their support of the MMA Report podcast. Once again, if you want to get a free online visit, all you got to do is go to GetRoman.com/MMAReport. Now, Daniel, last week when we were talking buy sell, we had a buy-sell about whether Ben Askren would fight in the UFC in the next 6 months, and it was probably about a couple hours after we did the podcast. Ariel Helwani came out with a report about this quote-unquote trade that was close to being finalized with UFC letting Demetrius Johnson go to ONE Championship and Ben Askren going to the UFC. And, you know, and of course, it now has gone through. And my overall thought on this situation is, it's a win-win for both sides. You know, ONE Championship had a welterweight champion, Ben Askren, that had retired. He wasn't going to fight for them again. And, you know, and Ben kind of had pretty much made it clear that if he was ever going to fight again, it'd likely be in the UFC. And Demetrius Johnson, he makes more sense for ONE Championships. I mean, And to me, I was, and my initial thought when this thing did go through, even though as of recording this podcast, the UFC has not come out and said we have signed Ben Askren, even though ONE Championship has already done a conference call with Demetrius Johnson. Demetrius had a great a great tweet on Sunday about it. But to me, this is a further indication of if you are a 125-pound fighter in the UFC, time to get with your strength coach and put on some weight because you're now a bantamweight fighter.
Yes, that's the big storyline here. Absolutely. I mean, my favorite thing is the social media stuff. You mentioned DJ, like for Ben Askren, I loved how he posted on like the 29th about how, hey, boss, time to unblock me. He's got like a picture of Dana White blocking him. And even on the 30th, I mean, you mentioned it, right? Why was the UFC not acknowledged it? You got Ben Askren saying, hey, at UFC, are you going to make an announcement? You're like that guy with the girlfriend who's embarrassed to tell his buddies, even when everyone knows, ha, 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 you know you love me, which, yeah, that rings true. Wow. Poor flyweight division. I mean, oh, my God. Jesus. I can't believe it that a guy in Demetrius Johnson who I get why this trade happened for sure. But at the end of the day, the UFC literally traded a guy who I think will go down as one of the greatest all-time fighters away. That's just what they did, point blank. They traded one of the greatest all-time fighters away in Demetrius Johnson. Now, they traded him for a good commodity in Ben Askren, who's going to provide some interesting fights right away, for sure. But it's very much, I think, to the NBA, and I think to the fact that very rarely do you see superstar, super-duper, pantheon-level guys get traded. Very rarely do you see the very best players. Like, I'm talking top two or three in the league, not like top 5 through 15. And that's where DJ is, in my opinion. Even though he came off that loss to Cejudo, prior to that loss, I think if he had just retired and we power ranked to best pound-for-pound fighters of all time, he's going to be, like, super high on that list. So that's important to note. But again, it just kind of shows that, man, maybe the flyweight division is on the way out, which is a bit of a shame. I don't really know what fights there are for DJ in ONE FC. I mean, to me, the Cejudo-Demetrius Johnson fight, I mean, the great irony is the Cejudo-Demetrius Johnson rematch would have been the biggest fight in flyweight history, in my opinion. I think that would have done the best. I mean, that's what people like to see. They like to see what happens after the all-time great gets knocked down. Then that rematch draws money. And I think Cejudo Johnson, too, would have drawn – I mean, Cejudo Johnson, too, probably does bigger pay-per-view than any Ben Askren fight except for a few. Like, I think there's a few fights with Ben Askren that do better business. But if we're being completely honest with you, I think Johnson Cejudo, too, probably outdraws what? Askren versus Covington? I think Johnson Cejudo – you really think Askren Covington would do bigger business than Cejudo Johnson?
Just because they would promote the fight in a way that would draw a different set of eyeballs.
That would be interesting. You might be right. You might be right. I just feel like not as many casual – I feel like very few people know who Ben Askren is outside of our MMA bubble is my general point.
Look, just remember, it was about 6 years ago that Dana White had the great tweet where he said – when Ambien can't sleep, it takes Ben Askren, the most boring fighter in MMA history. I would rather watch Fly's expletive.
Well, what's that Colby Covington, Ben Askren video package going to look like? Just like takedown after takedown?
I mean, look, it's, you know, from a sporting aspect, I love to watch Demetrius Johnson fight. He's one of the great, you know, one of the all-time great fighters. But you tell me, like... I'm just so enamored with seeing Ben Askren in the UFC because can he do what he does that he has done throughout his career? There are certain guys in that welterweight division that do not want to see Ben Askren because they are going to get taken down and they're not getting up.
Oh, that's like literally most of the guys. Absolutely. Ben Askren is one of the best wrestlers we've seen. And the reason why I'm pretty happy about this, even though we're losing Demetrius Johnson again, a legend in this sport, is that we're finally going to answer the question of how good Ben Askren is. I'm so excited to see that. Like, I hate unanswered questions in the sport, and now we finally get to see Ben Askren under the bright lights. I mean, you match him up with some of these severely talented guys like Lawler, Stephen Thompson, Dos Anjos, Kamaru Usman, Darren Till. It's like, even if these guys may be better than him from a talent level, like if this was a UFC game and it's like you have 95 striking, like 72 grappling, like whatever, clinch game, these guys probably would have better numbers than him, but he has 99 wrestling. And that's going to allow him to beat all these guys. And that's why the Covington matchup's interesting, sort of, even though I would still, honest to God, man, you line up Ben Askren with anybody in that top 15, I think I'm picking him in every fight except for against a champion.
Why?
That's kind of how I feel about it.
Why do I have a general feeling that Ben Askren, Colby Covington will be the co-main event of UFC 233?
Well,
with the main event being TJ Dillashaw versus Henry Cejudo.
I think the reason being is that that's a hell of a fight and that's a hell of a co-main event. I think if the main event's Dillashaw Cejudo, that's going to need a strong number two.
Oh yeah, cuz look, let's just be honest about it. From a MMA bubble perspective, that's a fight you want to see. Dillashaw and Cejudo, you know, 135 pound champion, 125 pound champion. Well, how would that fight go down? But in terms of getting a different set of eyeballs to the television set, you need two dudes in the main event that are just going to talk a bunch of trash to each other and get people excited about the fight.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see Askren really put his best foot forward when it comes to trash talk. Because it's been a while since he's had the opportunity to go about doing that. And the first time he fights in the UFC, it's going to be very important for him to build that star. Because, again, I don't think his name resonates with casuals. So it may be. You put himself in a UFC pay-per-view and he allows himself to do it, he could be a star could be born, you know, much like the Jennifer Lawrence, or no, the Lady Gaga movie, you know, a star could be born of Ben Askren for sure. And he could just run, go and take all the momentum Colby Covington has been building in one fight.
I remember being in the building when he took on Carl Amasu. And look, there was a lot of people in, I remember being in Oklahoma that week and 2-3 days before the fight, it seemed to be like a lot of people thought, man, Carl might catch him. And then all of a sudden the fight happens and Carl can't get off his back. And then, you know, of course, everybody remembers what he did to Andre Koreshkov. I believe the stat was 297-3 total strikes landed.
Yeah, it was something like that. I remember
it was crazy. It was nuts of what it was. But, I mean, look, I'm, you know, and I know you mentioned this to me. I mean, look, buy, sell, and the UFC flyweight division exists in a year. All caps, S-E-L-L. It is not going to be around, folks. It is. You might as well just buy that. It's not. The flyweight division to me, I don't know if it's around in January of 2019.
That's depressing, but it's true. It really is. And it's sad because I want to see what happens. Guys like Alexander Pantoja, Brandon Moreno, those fighters, they really thrive in this flyweight division. But again, you're just talking about all these guys going to bantamweight. There is interest there. And, I mean, when your champion wants to go to bantamweight, the whole division is going to follow. So, yeah, I am selling this too. I don't think the division's around. And it presents an opportunity for a rival promotion like Bellator to institute a flyweight division. And start bringing these guys start bringing these fighters who don't feel comfortable fighting at 135. That at least provides value. And it's like, if you're Bellator, maybe the long-term play is try to get Demetrius Johnson in the fold. Build yourself up to be – I don't know what the contract situation is like for Johnson, but it's like if you add him, that's a real player in the MMA landscape. It really is. I mean, he's not the biggest name in the world. But if he had the ability to offer Demetrius Johnson a contract and get him signed, he's not a draw, but he still really would be a momentum shifter.
All right, let me ask you this. You're Scott Coker. You bring in 125 pounds?
Yes. Yes, because to me, if you're not the UFC, you have to ask yourself, what is the UFC not addressing? And then you address it.
I think you can make a case. Is Bellator even – are they interested in 135 pounds right now?
I don't think so.
Because pretty much their champion's out 145.
Yeah.
So I don't – when you look at it, if the UFC can't make that division work, why would Scott Coker think I'm the right guy? Because it's not like they this was a one-year experiment by the UFC. This was, what, 5-6 years of an experience. I mean, you know, in the United States, fans just – I mean, they just aren't interested in it.
I don't know, man, because I've always been the person – people are interested in stars. They're not interested in weight classes. I mean, they're more interested in some weight classes than others. But the thing with the UFC is, God, time and again, they didn't necessarily put the same infrastructure in the flyweight division they did other divisions. I mean, how many times were compelling flyweight contests buried on the prelims? That happened often. And the flyweight division isn't the sexiest division. It's one of the least sexiest divisions in the entire industry for sure. But my general point is, again, if you're Scott Coker, there is value in doing what the UFC is not doing, in providing what the UFC is not providing. Even if the UFC could not provide a very marketable, profitable flyweight division, the fact that they kill their division and there's talent available there, and the fact that you could theoretically say we have the best flyweight champion in the world, you look at some of these cards Bellator has on, some of them are absolute crap. Why not at least attempt to do a flyweight division is what I'm saying. Is like, I know they have one foot out the door in the bantamweight division, but I still think, again, there's value in absolutely going after what the UFC is leaving at the table.
I don't think they will. I think if Bellator was going to get in the 125-pound business, it would have already happened.
Yeah, I certainly.
I think their focus is 145 and up. I don't think there's a focus for them under 145 pounds.
Yeah, and I certainly see. I think that they won't do it, but I suggest they would. Is my general point. Here's a question for you, Jason. Does Demetrius Johnson ever return to the UFC?
Ooh, I would say no. I think what you're going to see, I think you're just going to kind of see him do the one thing, however long that contract ends up being. Maybe see him take a fight in Ryzen, maybe fights in Bellator at some point. I would say I think it's more likely he has a fight in Bellator before he has a fight in the UFC again.
Totally agree with you. I think DJ is going to go get his money and get out.
Hey, good for him, man. Get that money.
Yeah. I mean, I think the only fight we're going to see out of him that's interesting is probably going to be something like, I don't know how Ryzen works with the 1FC, but I mean, maybe a fight with Kyoji Horiguchi down the line. I think that's like the one interesting fight we could see out of Johnson.
Here would be the very interesting part. Whenever DJ makes his one debut, whenever Eddie fights in one, how many fans that watch each of those fighters' last fights watches their fight live in one?
Probably like 100. I don't know. Maybe a couple thousand.
That's my thing. Like, people talk about one, and look, I want to see those guys succeed. But I just ultimately, if you're paying what allegedly people are saying they're getting paid, how do you make money on that?
Yeah. I just assume they have a lot of money. They don't care about making money. Like, that's just my general assumption based on the 1FC business model and the news that's been happening. I just assume they have a lot of money and they don't care.
Yeah, those articles by John Nash and Paul Giff did not put one championship in a good light.
Yeah. I think under the microscope, it's kind of ugly. But it's just, I think they're just putting on events. And yeah, it's a... I don't think you're looking at 1FC as a real player in the MMA landscape other than to help UFC in an antitrust lawsuit.
I mean, look, it's people will call it a trade. It's not really a trade when you really think about it. It's more of like, hey, we're going to release this guy out of a contract. You can sign him, and we're going to release that guy, and you can sign him. I mean, that's really what it was. I mean, I know there was a commenter on the MMA Report that was kind of, making all these kind of trades of, Bellator do this. I mean, look, why would the UFC send someone to Bellator? If the UFC wanted to send someone to Bellator, that's probably you might want to question, why are they wanting to send him to me? So I don't know if maybe your opinion difference, but I don't think this is going to be like a sign of the times.
No, I don't think people love trades, but I don't think MMA is a sport that lends itself to trades. we don't really see trades in any sport that isn't like a team sport where they're all owned by the same league or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we're not going to see trades. This was a very random occurrence.
Yeah, random occurrence. But, look, I'm interested to see, who Ben Askren comes in against. His Twitter timeline has been on absolute fire the past couple of days. Something we should note, Anthony Smith got the win over Volkan Oezdemir this past weekend at the UFC Fight Night card up in Canada. Of course, Mitch has his comments about John Jones. Anthony Smith, you have to consider him a top five guy. Arlen Lobov, loses again, a unanimous decision loss to Michael Johnson. Misha Cirkunov gets submission win over Pat Cummings. Andre Sukunthot with a decision win over Jonathan Martinez. John Volante defeats Ed Herman via split decision. When I was watching that fight, I felt like I was watching basically the same exact fighter between the two of those guys and what they are. Court McGee, the decision win over Alex Garcia. Sean Strickland, Calvin Kattar, some of notes. Also, Don Madge on the prelim, the knockout against T. Edwards. Definitely did not see that one coming. But obviously, the big thing come out of that UFC card, clearly, was Anthony Smith. I don't think there was anything in that fight that made you say, this is a guy I could see dethroning John Jones or Alex Gustafsson.
No, not at all. I mean, the first two rounds are Volkan Ozdemir's rounds. He was up 28-18 on my scorecard. And then Anthony Smith took advantage of a tired Ozdemir, brought him down, tapped him out. It was a solid win for Anthony Smith. But again, it's not like this guy is not jumping the line for a light heavyweight title shot. He's going to find himself in another light heavyweight fight. But I mean, it was a solid win for Anthony Smith, and nothing out of this world for sure. I mean, Johnson looked great against Arlen Loboff. It's a shame that he missed weight and featherweight. And then, I mean, to me, yeah, the most impressive performances were what? Don Maj's head kick knockout. And also Misha Serkinov. I mean, he just completely tooled Patrick Cummins, just freaking defended the takedown, brought him down, tapped him out. So, I mean, those are kind of the names that stuck out to me on this card.
Yeah, and Calvin Kattar, of course, you heard his manager and coach here early on, Tyson Chartier. That was the final fight on his UFC deal, so we'll see what happens with him next. You know, we do want to wrap up this week's podcast, talk about some of the various MMA news and notes. One of the bigger news items that really came out last week in relation to Bellator, Kevin Kay out at Viacom, the man who runs Comedy Central, now running Paramount. You know, we've talked about it for weeks. Bellator clearly just is not a fit on the Paramount Network. It kind of makes you wonder, maybe is this a sign to come to where? But, you know, Kevin Kay, I mean, you know, he is a guy that took all the UFC's money for the Ultimate Fighter back in, you know, 2005. And, you know, really catapulted the MMA to what it is today. So that's really some big news there. Also, on Tuesday, Combate America has announced they're going to do a one-night, eight-man tournament in California. You know, one of the things when I got the press release, the rules of this tournament were not announced, but I do know in the California rules, there can only be five rounds in one night. So, you know, maybe that's going to be one thing. Maybe the first and second round are one-round fights, and then the finals is a three-round fight, so we'll see what happens there. UFC 233, which is going to be on January 26th in Anaheim, the same night as the Bellator card in Inglewood at the Forum with Fedor and Bader. You know, we'll see kind of how that goes down there. Also, Khabib Nurmagomedov's manager, Ali Abdelaziz. I saw this article before we started doing the show today, basically saying that he wants Khabib to get paid $50 million for his next fight. Ali, you need to be realistic in your thoughts. That's great to say, not realistic.
Absolutely stupid. Like, come on, chill out. Man, California battle, same day, UFC 233, Bellator, Kevin Kay, a hugely notable figure in the history of MMA. You imagine it. I mean, he greenlit the Ultimate Fighter, an incredible opponent, and I think that means we will not see much MMA on the Paramount Network. When you look at this Combate Americas thing, here's my suggestion, and this may not even be true. Is it five rounds or is it 20?
Five rounds in one night is according to California rules, you can only fight five rounds in one night.
So here's my thing. What if it's 25 minutes? Can you do 3-minute rounds and do 25 minutes worth of rounds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you could do 2 fights that are 3-minute, 3-round fights in the quarters, semis, and then do a normal fight. That's my suggestion. I don't know if it would actually work, Jason, but what if you did 3-minute rounds?
I think it has to be 5-minute rounds as a pro fight.
Oh, okay. What if you did 2 amateur fights?
Let's do an amateur one night, 8-man tournament. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's a cool concept. You know, obviously you got to do things in this sport to separate yourself when you're initials are not the UFC. You know, I mean, Combate is now on DAZN. So if you have a DAZN subscription, you can watch it. But yeah, that was the one thing in the press release. I'm like, oh, so the press release doesn't say the rules. It tells you who four of the fighters are in the tournament, but doesn't tell you the rules.
Okay. That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're so aware of this after the PFL tournament, right? It's such a talking point. It's so obvious that, like, this is hard to do one night tournament. So it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, we'll see what happens at Copa Combate. Maybe they should just do the show like across the border. You know?
Well, they had the one night tournament. Where did they do it at? Oh man, man, I think it was in Mexico they did it before, but
let's do it in Mexico.
The press release did note how this was the first time ever in California, which Josh Grosch basically noted that, yeah, there's been some other one-night tournaments in California. This, they just weren't promoted by the California State Athletic Commission. So it's going to be kind of interesting to kind of see how that does play out. But I don't know if you've known this, Daniel. You realize we're like in a stretch of like 7 straight weeks of UFC events?
I just assume we're always in a stretch of UFC events every week. But for real, 7 straight weeks of previews and recaps?
Yeah, I will say this. I do like the main event more next week than I did before. You know, Frankie Edgar had to pull out of the fight due to an injury. I thought he was actually going to just wreck the Korean Zombie. But Korean Zombie now gets Yair Rodriguez. I like that fight from a competitive aspect much more than the previous fight.
And it's also going to be probably more enjoyable to watch because, like, those two guys are freaking amazing. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's like, you know, we no longer have the Demolition Derby. We now have an amazing back-to-back main event, co-main event lineup. I mean, Cerrone, Perry, Korean Zombie, Yair Rodriguez. Oh, my gosh. But I totally – and also, oh, my God, you know who's the big winner? And it's going to be a time race. It's going to be a race. Will Joseph Benavidez win the flyweight title before the division is dead? Guy, DJ has been his boogeyman.
Okay,
his
entire career. Buy, sell. There will be another UFC flyweight title fight.
Oh, man, that's a great – I'm going to buy it. For Joseph Benavidez, it's going to be the retirement flyweight championship.
Oh, no,
fight.
I'm selling it, man. I'm selling it. Cejudo's going up to 35, the challenge for the title.
Joseph Benavidez deserves one last shot. Joseph Benavidez versus, I don't know, Juicier Formiga, flyweight title fight, and it's also retired. That's my suggestion.
Benavidez has got to get a win, though.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to be Ray Borg, so, like, you know, that's going to be tough.
You got to remember, he's coming off that loss against Sergio Pettis.
Yeah.
Who now is a 130, has moved up to 135 exactly. To take on Rob Font.
Exactly. So, you know, all I want is for Benavidez to have gold around his waist once.
Oof. I just don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right.
If the flyweight division is ultimately over here in the next couple of months, it'd be interesting to see how many of those guys currently in the top 15 are in the UFC 24 months from now.
I think most of them, honestly.
I think some of those guys that are not big flyweights go up to 35, and all of a sudden they're fighting guys that walk around like 160, 170 pounds.
Yeah, I think you're talking about like 12 of those guys sticking around, and maybe 3 of those.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's, you know, but at the end of the day, I mean, look, why is it going away? Is it just fans just didn't show the interest in the division? I mean, that's the harsh reality of it.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, there was not a single flyweight fight that got a whole lot of interest.
Yeah, so, of course, we got UFC 230 coming up this weekend. If you're looking to make a bet on the fights, be sure to check out our friends over at MyBookie. Use our promo code MMAReport, and the MMAReport podcast listeners will get their first deposit match 100%. So be sure to check out them. Also, be sure to check out Romans as well. You can get a free online visit by going to getroman.com/MMAReport. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMAReport podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is a Landry Football with Chris Landry. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
People have asked me, why are we seeing more of it? Well, because it's later in the season and there's a more definitive line of who are potential players in the run for the playoffs, and as well as I think you're seeing a generation of new GMs. And having been around this league a long time, I'm seeing more and more GMs, some ex-players like an Elway and a John Lynch, that really don't have a background in coaching or scouting. And you have other guys like a Howie Roseman, who's more of a business background. They don't have the confidence, nor have they had a lot of success in the draft, where, you know, they feel confident in many cases and more along the line, more inclined to go out and buy somebody else's players, trade for somebody else's player on a quick fix. Because there's an old saying in scouting. I've worked in both pro personnel and college scouting at the NFL level, and the pro personnel guys have an easier job because the pro personnel guys are just evaluating players that are already in the league. And all you have to do is grade how they've done against the players that you want to see them do it against, NFL players. The real gem and the real skill of scouting is the ability to do it evaluating college players, because you're projecting all of those guys. No guy that is ever in college, before they get in the NFL, they've never played pro ball. So everything is a projection. So knowing how they evaluate and having experience of being able to do it over years and years has a tremendous impact on your ability to evaluate. And a lot of these young guys are not really good at it and have made a lot of mistakes and tend to go for the quick fixes. So this is the other thing is just the modern age that we're in. You can't develop and do things like you are supposed to do them. You have to win immediately. And if you're not winning, you have to turn it around immediately, or else everybody is completely impatient. So all of that's led to more activity around this trade situation.
Chris Landry brings you Landry Football every week on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.